January 30th, we are in the office of Dr. Walter Jacob, and Gabby Dinman is taking notes. Mary Harrison is doing the recording, and this is tape 11, side 22. And this is the oral history, phase 2.
All right, later today we're going to have a 6-month celebration of this effort.
You know what?
You know, and who's paying? That's what I want to know. Gabby Dinman is just telling you how broke council is. I don't know. You going to treat us?
Sure.
Okay. One of the first things that I wanted to talk about is from our last interview. You mentioned the Good News Bible.
I don't know that has anything to do with me.
It's a Bible, and I just wondered what it is. It's evidently a new Bible.
No, it's simply a Bible in a modern English translation in an effort to have a colloquial translation with less attention on scholarship.
Doesn't sound like you're very approving.
No, I like it.
You think it's practical?
I use it a lot with teenagers particularly because they can read it. It's English. Okay. It's their English.
Okay, Walter, we talked about Mimi Lerner. There's some things that are not, that we know, but it should be on tape. What is her history? I know she's a Metropolitan Opera star, and I want to know what you knew about her and when she came to Temple.
Okay. Mimi Lerner grew up, she is the child of survivors. She met after the war, probably in a camp or in France. She grew up in France, Paris, then came to the United States, was educated here. I mean, she started her life in France. Came to Pittsburgh, and first taught, I believe, the Suzuki method, not the Suzuki, a method like that. Of teaching music to very young children, and at the same time continued to develop her own singing career. Did cantorial work in a few of the smaller synagogues, and then came to Temple as our cantorial soloist. That was her role for number of years, then she became the last, I think it's 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, our music director. So she's not only sings, but trains the choir, selects the music. Before that, we had organists who were also music directors, were very good people, but the problem with them was that they were not Jewish. Very difficult to find a Jewish organist. I know of only one who was here for a while. Her name was Heidi Block. A very nice and able young woman, but then wanted to move on to something else. So this enables us to select music with more of a background. And Mimi has a good background. She knows what she is singing, she knows what the text means, and knows a fair amount about liturgy, and selects music which is both represents the more classical tradition and the modern tradition. And she's also in tune with what we've been trying to do, which is to get the congregation to sing, and emphasis on that rather than a lot of solo work. She's done singing, opera singing, and concert singing all over the world, including some roles at the Met and lots of roles in Italy and South America, at Glyndebourne, a great English opera festival, and lots of other places like that.
How old is Mimi?
Mimi's about 50. Mimi also has the fine quality of being quite willing to teach adults who have no voice to sing. And so she works with congregants almost every Shabbat for a half hour before services to get them to understand the melody, or to work with kids. You know, many people at that level of singing consider this below their dignity and wouldn't be bothered with it. But she enjoys that and does it very well.
Okay, Walter, we talked a good bit.
And you know, we had other cantorial solos, either part-time or full-time before her, as we slowly built up that tradition, because before that time we had simply had a choir.
They were mostly non-Jews, right?
Yes, not exclusively, but we tried to get the best voices, not necessarily the best Jewish voices, and often there wasn't that much choice. For a long time, the music director here was a man named Dr. Charles Pearson, who was here for probably 50 years, who certainly knew the repertoire very well, and bought also all the classical material. And I remember asking him on a series of once a month concerts on Sundays, when we had Sunday services, to present music of Rossi, music of Naumburg, music of some of the other classical Zoltzer composers, and he was able to put together some very nice concerts. I should also mention that, of course, we had Dr. Jenkins here for some time, who is a composer, a well-recognized composer, has done some lovely things which have been performed nationally, and composed some very nice pieces for us.
Is he still with Duquesne? Or?
He's with Duquesne. He continues to teach at Duquesne. We spent an evening together just last weekend. For special music over the years, special Jewish music, we've gone down two different roads. One is we have had outside groups come in, great variety from klezmer groups to the West Point Jewish Choir, and a variety of Jewish artists who presented only Jewish music. I'm not talking now about the general concerts. And from time to time have done special musical performances. So that was largely under the direction of Stanley Levin. So we're going back about 15 years and more. But things like King Saul with a full orchestra, or Bernstein's service, or Bloch's service, or the Chichester Psalms, those kinds of things, which are wonderful to do, but very expensive. You always have to we tried to do them through our own choir and then augmented them with voices, because you rarely had a good balance with volunteers.
All right, Walter. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what your relationship was, and a little bit about William Friedberg. We have interviewed William Friedberg, but I'd like to know a little bit about what your philosophically, some of the things that you mentioned last week, because I was fortunate enough to know her. There's a lot of similarity in some of the things.
We were friends through the years, and often worked together. What I particularly liked about Lillian was that she headed an agency which at that point was independent. She had a board.
What was the name?
The Community Relations Agency. But it was not a subgroup of the Federation. And this board gave her a great deal of leeway. And so her agency often became the home for new groups that were starting out, and for offbeat groups whom other people didn't want to either recognize or take the risk of recognizing. And so some of these were, many of these were civil rights groups. Others were groups that dealt with very specific problems that then evaporated, and the problem was solved. We didn't need an organization anymore. So she provided a place where people could hang their hat, some secretarial help, and a good bit of guidance. When she retired and this agency was reorganized, and there was a real gap in the communal structure, which still exists to some extent, I tried a temple here to fill the same kind of role. And when somebody came, nobody was willing to house them or to provide any secretarial support or any other support. We've got a big building. There's always a place where you can sit and make a few phone calls. So try to be hospitable in the same way. And she was a good, loyal member of the congregation with strong views on many subjects. We had lots of interesting discussions. And one should not overlook her husband, who, very different, a fine physician, and also had his own points of view, which didn't always agree with Lily.
Was she head of the Anti-Defamation League?
No.
Never.
Okay.
Sure. Well, since I mentioned the Anti-Defamation League, what is your opinion?
Well, you know, there are
the board of
variety of defense agencies, and they try each in their own way with their own philosophy and approach to, in periods of anti-Semitism, to help us, and in other periods to broaden their efforts and to look after other allied causes which deserve a helping hand. Well, particularly blacks, Afro-Americans, or however, over the decades we have designated this group. And so the American Jewish Committee particularly has been involved in a broad civil rights campaign, which in other cities has gone down other roads too. Problems with Hispanics, large areas of the South. Here, they've tried very hard to establish good relationships with other ethnic groups. Not necessarily, this is not fighting anti-Semitism. This is going beyond that and trying to establish a basis so that if an incident arises, either here or overseas, you've got some contacts and you've got a decent relationship and you can help each other. And it goes both ways. So that, for example, in the crisis in Yugoslavia, which involved Croats and Serbians, lots of other minority groups there, the fact that some interrelationship had been established here, partly through the efforts of the American Jewish Committee, first of all helped to see to it that the conflict didn't spread to these shores, and secondly provided a basis for some conversations across the ocean too. Now the Anti-Defamation League does a little less of that. It's more involved in direct efforts, not entirely, but more restricted to Jewish causes.
Going to ask you this a little later, but I think it's appropriate at this point. Walter, if we talk about anti-Semitism, and do you find that there is any feeling of anti-Christians and Jews? Do you Is there a reverse of this? Maybe it could be, some people would say it might be a backlash.
No.
Through the years, have you found any?
No.
The Jews are not anti.
No, I've never seen any Jews with anti-Christian people. Perhaps a lot of Jews don't know much about Christianity, aren't particularly interested in learning about Christianity, especially in the older generation. But I haven't, you know, they're not anti.
Also, what are your thoughts on the ACLU?
Organization. Don't always agree with them, but it certainly has done a good deal. It's positive, helpful.
Okay, we talked about Billy Graham last week and his inauguration. I'm just curious what your opinion of him is as a minister, his role in America. Do you have any opinions?
Well, you know, he's played a major role in American Protestant life of one kind. He's an important figure. I've never met him. I've witnessed revivals of various kinds in the Midwest, particularly in Springfield, Missouri, in that area. He's certainly been open to dialogue, and so has his organization. So he's a fundamentalist who is not closed off, as some fundamentalists, of course, are.
The four campuses of the
yeah, we're really going to all sorts of areas.
You know why? Because
we just
have
left Billy Graham. Now we're to the Hebrew Union College.
Well, you know what we're doing, Walter. We meet after each interview, and these are gaps. And
well, you know, Billy Graham only came up because the last interview
right.
was right after the inauguration.
Right.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have dealt with
it. I'm not so sure about that, but what we do, Walter, is while we're listening to the interviews, and this last one I listened to, and then Gabi and I meet on these things, there are gaps, and there are just certain things. If a name is mentioned, such as
I'll be very careful not to mention it.
Oh, we did an interview. You remember that?
Privilege.
Where where somebody was constantly, and every time he mentioned a name. It was another hour interview. It was really, really funny. But that was part of his life. There are four campuses, one in Israel, one in Cincinnati, one in New York. Is the other one in L.A.?
Yes.
Walter, what is the consensus of the Conference of American Rabbis on internet? Is there a consensus?
Yes, there is an official position, first of all, every rabbi, regardless of what they may do personally, are opposed to intermarriage and do their best to see to it that it doesn't occur. Secondly, the conference in the first decade of the century, and then again in the 40s, and the third time in the late 70s, passed resolutions indicating that that it is opposed to rabbis officiating mixed marriages. Of course, a rabbi can follow his own conscience, his or her own conscience, after this. And so there are rabbis who do officiate under various kinds of agreements with the couple.
What are some of what the children do?
Well, it usually goes beyond that. For example, Jamie Gibson here in town insists that the couple take a course, study Judaism. He even if there's no intention to convert, and be a member of the congregation, come to services. In other words, a commitment to lead a Jewish life, at least as much as is possible without actually being Jewish.
And the other partner that would have to give up whatever?
You don't have to give up anything. But that's not part of that commitment on his part. But they have to go down that road. And so, it's not simply somebody walking off the street and saying, I want to get married, would you marry me? There are lots of phone calls like that, which all of us have gotten. And I think all of us, regardless of what our stand is, have always told people, look, I don't want to discuss this over the telephone. This is something that should be done face to face. So unless it's a mother calling who is already angry, you can usually talk to the couple and get them to maybe not agree with your point of view, but understand. And really, almost never had a problem with a couple. I can remember lots of problems with parents, but not with couples.
They do the field work before.
No, no. If a couple comes in and they know ahead of time what my stand is on this, but they want to talk to me about it. Okay, so we talk. And I try to explain it to them, the rationale behind it. Nobody has ever, on that basis, either walked out angry or said, well, if that's your point of view, I'm going to leave Judaism or whatnot. But they have, and sometimes the conversation has gone on for a couple of hours, different days, have inevitably said, okay, I understand your feelings and your point of view on this, and we'll proceed down a different road. Parents, or sometimes they'll say, well, we'll consider conversion now that you've laid this out and explained it in some detail. Parents, on the other hand, often simply say, look, I've been a member of this congregation for a very long time. This is the only thing I've ever asked of you, and if you don't give it to me, I'm going to resign. Yeah. And then if you say, well, why don't we come talk about it? I'll be happy to come over to your house. You can come over here. No, there's nothing to talk about. You know,
this is it.
Yes, it's often it's interesting that such a different attitude on the part of one generation versus another. So the stand of the official position of the Central Conference is very clear.
And then a rabbi who is a member, such as, I guess there's one here in Pittsburgh, who is what, Temple Sinai?
If he wants to follow a different pattern, he's free to.
He is.
Yes. The only thing that, where the conference will apply sanctions, is if a rabbi officiates with another clergy.
That's a taboo, is that it? I mean, that's a taboo.
That's absolutely out. Yes. So if that's what you do, then you're out of our range.
Why is that?
Why? Because what's the sense of officiating with somebody from another religion? They're certainly not going to be Jewish. We're not interested in syncretism.
Walter mentioned, Chuck Decker, when did he die? He was president of the...
He died 2.5 years ago.
The the Hebrew schools. I know there's one in O'Hara or Fox Chapel. Where are the others? Is that a one, aren't there?
Yes, there's one in Churchill, and one in Fox Chapel, and one in O'Hara.
No,
way up in the North Hills.
It's North Hills, I know that. Yeah, that's North Hills.
Yeah.
And the other is O'Hara Township.
So there are three.
There are three, yes.
And is Harold Goldman still principal of the school?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Harold has been, first of all, he's been extremely devoted and has served the congregation in one way or another for 25 years. Has been head of the religious school for 10 or 11 years and has filled this very difficult position beautifully because it's a position with a constant series of headaches. I think we've been over some of those before.
Yeah.
He's lucky too that he has a very creative wife, Barbara, who has lots of ideas, and so he's able to supply the administrative strength which he has. He's a vice principal in one of the public schools. And she's able to supply ideas and organize those ideas. You know, it's one thing to have ideas. A reasonable number of people have ideas, although the number's not that great. But it's another to be able to carry them into practice. And she's able to do that. Bring the parents in for special programs. Do nice, unusual things with the kids. Get the kids to do some things that at first you think are ridiculous. For example, we had a series of creative services in which the kids were in contact with major Jewish personalities and asked them, what makes them Jewish? So you write to, you know, an anchor man or anchor woman on NBC as an eighth grader, and you figure you never get an answer. But you do get an answer. They get a very nice answer.
What a neat idea.
So, you know, these things, that kind of stuff, we've done over many years. Or things that bring people in the community in contact with people in the religious school. Again, people that you normally think, they're really going to bother. So we've several times had mayors of Pittsburgh here. I'm not just talking about Sophie Maslow, but Tom Murphy, Kelly Jury, talking to a couple of classes in the religious school. You know, what's city government like? Or a congressman? And people are very willing to do this. It's not a vote. It doesn't get them any votes. But they're interested in developing a relationship between government and kids.
And what is Barbara's position?
She at the moment she is a curriculum designer, but before that she was what did we call her? Forgotten what the exact title was, but it was something like a developer of creative ideas. It had a different title, but she brought a great deal of that to the school.
And Harold has wonderful skills with children.
Good skills with children.
Excellent.
Good skills with parents, which is also not so easy. And with teachers. You know, you'd be surprised what attitudes parents have. And you tell kids, look, if you're going to be on the bima at a service, you have to dress decently. We don't want you to come in gym shoes. And so they come in gym shoes. And you call the parents. The parents say, how dare you tell my child what to wear? And, you know, you get these kinds of attitudes. And, or people, you assign something. Kid repeatedly comes back with no sign. You call up. The parent says, you know, my child is in a very demanding school. That comes first. If they have time, they'll do this. If not, don't bother me about it. You know, these kinds of things you've got to deal with. And even if you feel like exploding, you restrain yourself, try to reason with them, or just throw up your hands and say, all right, so your kid is not going to get an education. But it's that, and then you have a constantly new group of teachers with whom you have to deal, a new generation of teachers. And there were other good people before that, too. Mr. Simon for 4 or 5 years.
That was Saul?
Saul Simon, yes. The camp director.
Of Deer Creek?
Yes. Also very able and also involved with public school.
He was the president.
Yes. And before that, we had a short series of